Hello, and welcome to this podcast, just one of a series on the life and works of the early 19th century German writer Heinrich von Kleist. My name is Sean Allen, and I'm from the University of Warwick. And in today's podcast, I'll be talking about Kleist's novella, The Betrothal in San Domingo, with Professor Ricardo Schmidt and Dr. Stephen Howe, both from the University of Exeter. Kleist's The Betrothal in San Domingo was written and published in 1811, but there's, I think, quite a lot of evidence that it was conceived of in 1802. But one of the things that I think is most striking about this story is that it was actually set in the immediate present. And it refers to contemporary events of which Kleist's public would have been well aware. And I wonder if you could tell us, Steve, something about this kind of historical background.
Sure, and you're right, I think it's the only one of Kleist's major works which has this kind of up-to-date setting. Usually he puts the action back into earlier periods, whereas he here offers a version of modern European history, a fictionalised version of modern European history. The story is set in 1803 on the island of San Domingo, what is now Haiti. Haiti was at the time long established as the most lucrative of France's overseas colonies, largely on account of its sugar plantations. But with the outbreak of the French Revolution in 1789, it became something of a focus for political debate on the rights and status of the colonial slaves there. In 1791, the National Assembly, the revolutionary government in France, passed a decree emancipating the mulattoes, so those who were essentially half-caste. And then 3 years later, what was by then the National Convention passed a further decree emancipating all slaves. In late 1801, however, Napoleon, who has by this time risen to power, decided to rescind these measures and sent an expedition force back to the island to essentially reintroduce slavery. So you had this bloody, violent conflict that followed. While the French had initial success, forcing the blacks to surrender and imprisoning the leader, Toussaint Louverture, they eventually succumbed to a renewed uprising under the leadership of General Dessalines in late 1803. And on the 1st of January 1804, Haitian independence was declared. And so it's in that particular historical context that Kleist situates.
And Kleist himself, of course, had personal connections when he was imprisoned as a spy by the French. He was imprisoned in the very same fortress in which this black slave leader, Toussaint Louverture, had died. So, and he wrote about it to his sister without any further explanation, sort of indicating that Toussaint Louverture was at that time a very well-known, established figure. You didn't need to gloss the name. It was something people talked about.
I mean, people have described Haiti as the 18th century, 19th century Vietnam of its day.
Yes, and another connection Kleist had was in 1802, when he was in Switzerland and rented a little island. The brother of the person he rented the island from had actually himself died in the struggles in Haiti.
So the people of Kleist today would have had their own stories to tell in exchange.
Yes.
About the events on the island.
Yes. And the other thing, of course, it was very widely debated after the French Revolution. Was revolution a good way to change a society or not? And in this story, we've got, as it were, a double take, because there are references to the French Revolution and then, of course, mainly to the Black Revolution. So we've got two revolutions to think about here in this story.
Of course, one aspect of the story that has fascinated critics and readers alike is Kleist's presentation of the Black Haitians and, generally speaking, how he presents the Black Revolution, the Black Slave Revolt on Haiti. I wonder, Ricardo, would you go as far as to say that this story could be conceived of as pro-Black?
Well, the narrator starts quite starkly at the time when the blacks were murdering the whites. That sets quite a stark context. And in the course of this revolution, a lot of quite gruesome things happen, which seem to be not motivated by individual experience. So we've got our protagonist, Congo Hwango, is introduced by the narrator as a terrible old Negro, repaying his master's kindness and generosity by murdering him and his family. So there's no direct link between the actions of an individual and the treatment that this person is getting. So you get the impression as if the narrator is actually very much on the side of the whites, the way this is being presented. The general frenzy of vindictive rage is a term the narrator uses for the actions of the blacks.
Those are, of course, very loaded terms, I think. And, of course, we'll come on to talk about the narrator, I think, in a moment. But I wonder whether you could perhaps elaborate a little bit, because, I mean, some people would say, of course, that notions of moral decency and normal human behaviour, of course, aren't really applicable in a situation where the norm is, of course, slavery.
Yes, that is true, but we've got to look at what the story is doing. And the story is trying to give some sort of motivation of the black action. So we've got one general motive for Congo Hwango, because he remembers the tyranny that had snatched him from his native land. So that is given as something, but it's in the context of there's this general tyranny and the individual decent people who are, once it comes to the outbreak of the rebellion, you know, they're not distinguished from the general tyranny at all anymore. We also have Babacan, and her story is one of betrayal by a white lover, who doesn't own up to the paternity of her daughter, and she is then punished by her Villeneuve by whipping, and as a consequence she has a lifelong illness. So bits are given, but on the other hand there is not one character, one black character, from whose perspective all that black suffering is shown in detail.
Of course, as the story unfolds, we learn quite a bit about the individual circumstances of the black protagonists in the story, and some might say that that evidence could be cited as something that challenges the value judgment supplied by the narrator. How would you see that?
I would say the details supplement and nuance the presentation of the narrator. They provide some colourful detail of injustices of slavery and the resentment it breeds. But had Kleist wanted to write an anti-slavery story, I would think he could have done a lot better than this. And if we take Babacan as an example, she herself tells the story of her personal betrayal and her lifelong suffering to Gustav. But we do not experience her suffering from her point of view. So the consumption, for example, consumption is named as her illness as a consequence of her whipping. But consumption is not normally a consequence of whipping. And she contracted that a good 15 years ago. She hasn't died. Nobody in her family has died either. We're not shown how it affects her. We're not even told that she's coughing. Tony refers to her chest, but interestingly, at the moment she does it, she actually looks away from her chest and tells a lie. So the whole story isn't geared to telling the experience of slavery and how it feels to be a slave, but it's centered on the awakening of Tony, who so far had identified with the blacks and is now getting into a situation where she sees what she and the blacks had done so far critically.
So would you say that the story is simply neutral on slavery?
I think slavery isn't the primary issue of it. The issue is what happens if you rebel against injustices. And what is shown here is the people who rebel against injustices commit new injustices.
So injustice breeds injustice.
Yes.
Steve, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the presentation of the black characters in the novella, because, of course, one of the most striking features of it is that very few of the characters are actually straightforwardly black.
Yeah, and I think the presentation of the characters is quite complex in most cases. I think we can probably distinguish between a kind of a general representation of the blacks as a collective force in terms of their political, the attempt at rebellion, and also the presentation of one or two individuals who are sketched in slightly finer detail, although no, not that closely, but you know, aspects of whose characters also reflect on the blacks more collectively. I mean, the two main figures who are aligned on the black side in the story are obviously Congo Huango and his partner Barbican. Huango is, as Ricardo mentioned, described as this terrible old Negro.
And so he's really the only character in the story who's unambiguously black, or one of very few characters.
Yeah, in terms of skin colour, he's unambiguously black, yes. Morally, the representation of the figure is slightly more complex, with regard to readings that try to map these moral categories onto figures. On the one hand, he is fiercely determined for the black cause. He's one of the first to take up arms when the revolution breaks out. Again, as Ricardo's mentioned, he kills his former master, Herr Villeneuve, despite the fact that he's been treated with relative kindness. And I think you would have to say
not
relative
only
kindness.
Relative, in the context of the time, it was exceptional kindness. Because what he does is far beyond, it's even against the customs of the country. So, you know, if you look at it from a modern perspective and you find slavery abhorrent, then it's all relative. But in the context of the time, he was going against the customs of his time.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I do think that Kleist perhaps offers a slightly more critical view of Villeneuve than that, or rather not of Villeneuve himself, but of slavery more generally. Also, Huango has no qualms about using Tony as bait to lure passing whites to their deaths. He has these illegitimate children, and there's a kind of background suggestion of immorality there. But this is tempered by the fact that he's actually shown to be loving towards those children.
And even to Tony.
And to Tony as well.
Stepdaughter.
And ultimately that's why he surrenders to the whites, so as to avoid any risk of harm coming to his children.
In the story, of course, the whites are represented by Gustav von der Ried and his uncle Herr Strömli, who, together with their family, are fleeing from the attacking black rebels and are moving from Fort Dauphin to Port-au-Prince. I wonder, is it possible to kind of characterise their political position and allegiance, Ricardo?
Interestingly, they are not French. They're not representing the French colonial power. They're Swiss and are presented as quite naive characters to some extent. Gustav von der Ried supports the French. He's in the service of the French.
He's a mercenary, isn't he?
Yeah, but he seems to have thought very little about what he's doing. So, interestingly, when Tony asks him what the whites have done to make themselves so hated by the blacks, he is rather feeble in his reply and refers to some individuals having committed excesses, but justifies the rule of slavery, the colonial rule, with the positivistic argument that the legal institution of slavery had already existed for a long time.
Do you think that this naivety on Gustav's part is actually presented in the story as something that makes him morally culpable.
I think, yes, it does, but in an interesting way, because it's primarily through his passivity that he's culpable. And it also links to the French Revolution, because Gustav had experienced the dangers of mob violence during the French Revolution when he was to be executed for a critical remark made in public about the revolution. His fiancée was then guillotined in his place simply because he couldn't be found. So he had experience volatile situations revolutions can be. And oddly, for somebody who experienced such terrible atrocities at the hands of French revolutionaries, he then decides to serve Napoleon's troops in their attempt to regain control of an island where a rebellion against French colonial rule had broken out. So he's obviously not a political animal, you know, to fight for the very same people who murdered his fiancée.
He seems to be a mass of contradictions. And, of course...
He is. He supports the former oppressors against a rebellion targeted against them, and then hasn't even thought enough about it to be critical. Both during the French and the Black Rebellions, Gustav is presented as acting impulsively, foolishly, lacking political sensitivity, and thus getting into scrapes. So he is not acting from a position of strength or violence, but rather from a position of lack of thought. He's not presenting the image of white superiority, but, white feebleness, insecurity, fear. He's more persecuted than being a persecutor. And partly because of his insecurity, he then decides to seduce Tony, because that's his way of finding out, can he trust her or can't he?
Thank you, Ricarda. With these three groups of people, blacks, mixed race, white mercenaries, all caught up in a rebellion against French colonial rule, what would you say the story is trying to explore, Steve? Is it a story about individuals, or is it a story about rebellion and revolution?
I mean, I think for a long time it was generally read as almost typically Kleistian inquiry into these themes of trust, love, betrayal, misunderstanding, particularly focalised in the relationship between Gustav and Tony, whereby the revolutionary action is nothing more than a backcloth, really, for these themes. But I think more recently, and to my mind quite rightly, there's been a focus, or rather there's been a shift of focus towards the more directly political concerns in the text, and how Kleist actually embeds the love story within the context of the political action, and how he actually reveals something about the ethics and dynamics of revolution through their effects on the individuals, in a similar way that someone like Dickens does in A Tale of Two Cities.
It seems fairly likely to me that this story is an indirect way of discussing the French Revolution. And I wonder if you could tell us what you think it tells us about Kleist's attitudes to revolution, revolutionary change, and of course the French Revolution in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think he very obviously is referring indirectly to the French Revolution, directly at times in the text, but more generally in an indirect sense, he's engaging with the events of the French Revolution. My view is that Kleist's great skill here is that he actually lays bare the ethics and dynamics of revolution, particularly graphically, very candidly. You know, this is what happens in revolutionary contexts. I think he places the violence in a context that explains it, makes it understandable without necessarily condemning or condoning it, but rather presenting almost two perspectives on what's happening from both sides of both the oppressed and the oppressors. Mm-hmm. I think that being said, I think the main effect of the text is to spotlight certain of the dangers of popular revolution, a kind of revolution from below, mob violence. And I think that really comes across in two main ways. One is that from within the text, it seems that the black campaign of violence is driven essentially by a desire for vengeance rather than freedom. There doesn't seem to be that much talk of freedom from within the text itself. Others who have read it differently would place it into the historical context and say that this was turned into a fight for national independence on the part of the blacks on Haiti. But within the text itself, there's very, very little reference to freedom. It seems almost that the lust for revenge has almost clouded any goal of freedom that may originally have lain at the heart of the cause.
I recall, of course, the American critic Ray Fleming famously saying once about this story that what's missing is the voice of the dispossessed black other. What do you think he meant by that, Ricardo?
Well, if he wanted to write an anti-slavery story, then I think it would have been more effective had he centred it on the experiences of one of these blacks caught up in the rebellion. But instead, what he does is he centres it very much on Tony. Tony, the person who is three quarters white and just one quarter black, but has grown up in this black cultural context and has so far identified with that context. And what the story is mainly about is this particular figure who has been used as bait in luring white men to their death. She herself hasn't killed them, but she used her sexual attraction to trap them to get others to kill them.
She's, of course, very young in the story, isn't she?
Yes, that's also another intriguing thing, because she's 15. It's repeated three times, she's 15. Her mother is always referred to as the alte Babbekan, old Babbekan, and she's depicted as terribly decrepit, as if her age might interfere with her going to Europe. When Gustav von der Ried says he wants to marry Tony, he says, "Oh, and if her age permits, we'll get your mother to live with us in Switzerland." When you think about it, Barbican is in all likelihood in her very early 30s, younger than Kleist was at the time he wrote the story. But Kleist quite deliberately hadn't wanted us to see much of Barbican's perspective and her experiences. So beyond her little vignette of her betrayal by Tony's father, her Bertrand, we don't get to experience her, but we experience Tony. So the age difference between Tony and Barbican is artificially extended in order to enable the reader's identification with this young Tony and her first falling in love and a non-understanding hostile parent. So, it's not the active revolutionary whose experiences and perspectives and suffering and physical feeling is described, but Tony, we are getting into the inside of Tony, her guilt for what she's done.
And of course this is her first sexual experience, isn't it? Because mm-hmm. she's always forbidden to actually enter into sexual relations with the men that she's supposed to entrap.
Yes, and quite typical for good Kleistian women, they are completely committed to their men. If they're not, they're immediately bad. And Tony here is sort of predicated by Gustav's two emblematic stories. He virtually gives her the choice. The first story was the black slave girl who consciously, deliberately infected a master who had once pressed her for sexual favours with the yellow fever. And his first question was, would Tony be capable of such a thing? And that makes Tony see what she's done so far in a different light. Obviously, she hasn't slept with anybody because she was forbidden, but she lured them with her sexual attraction. And the second one was the Marianne story, and that's presented as the story of infinite human goodness, and that's the story that Tony opts for as a model, and she's of course given the cross, the chain with the cross that the fiancé wore as the sign of their betrothal. And she follows in the footsteps of wanting self-sacrifice for her beloved. So gender and race converge in that, in this idea of self-sacrifice as being the morally good thing to do. And of course, she does die in the end. So the good woman is the dead woman.
Towards the end of the story, just when Tony thinks she's on the point of taking leave of her mother and running off with Gustav, she tries to explain her allegiance by saying the following. She says, "I have not betrayed you. I am a white girl and betrothed to this young man whom you are holding prisoner. I belong to the race of those with whom you are openly at war, and I will be answerable before God for having taken their side." I wonder what you make of that statement.
The moral female position is characterised by self-sacrifice, by death. And yet there's a sting in the tail, because ultimately she is not following in Marianne's footsteps, because Marianne had already, had of course saved Gustav. And Marianne died at the hands of Gustav's enemies. But here, the moral position that Tony reaches, she dies at Gustav's hands, and Gustav doesn't survive her on discovering what he has done. So it's a self-sacrifice that doesn't lead to anything noble in the end. And yet, I don't think you can completely simply say everything is negative, because her death is described as her breathing out her beautiful soul. And this beautiful soul, Schöne Seele, is of course a reference to classicism and the notion of morality. So in spite of not having achieved her ultimate aim, you know, she still has achieved that moral status. But in typical Kleistian fashion, you know, there is not simply this wonderful convergence between the moral status and then the reward. She has achieved the moral status without getting the reward. And she is, of course, referred to as faithful, die treue Toni, and the exchanging of rings, as happens so often in Kleist's stories. That the union is achieved only in death rather than in life. So makes then for a rather grim ending, in spite of a glimpse of something positive.
Well, Ricardo's charted out very clearly, I think, the moral journey that might be said that Tony undergoes during the novella. But of course, there is this other system of ethics that's put forward in the novella, by Babacan in particular, this collectivist notion of ethics, that one is, of course, guilty by association, that Gustav is somehow guilty by being a member of the white race. How would you read that in the context of the novella as a whole?
Well, I mean, I actually think that it's the system of collectivist ethics which forces Tony's hand, so to speak, when she declares, "I am a white girl." I don't think this is something that she's necessarily saying of her own volition. She initially tries to speak in moral terms to Babacan at that point and persuade her of her allegiances, but Babacan is so, she has such a rigid system of ethics in mind, this collectivist ethics, that she's simply incapable of understanding that in that context. And it's only when those arguments fail, those moral arguments, individualist moral arguments fail, that Tony suddenly has to declare allegiance, so to speak. And I think that has to be seen in the context of the French Revolution and that radicalisation of policy that occurred particularly between 1792 and 1794, that emerged in a dialectic of absolute loyalty or absolute treachery, with there being no middle ground. And I think that in this particular case,
that Kleist is taking, or rather the text takes a critical view of a system of ethics that knows no space for moral autonomy or for an individualist ethics.
So you could say that the story argues that just as colour can't simply be reduced to black or white, so too ethics, politics, can't simply be reduced to either or categories.
I think in this text, yes. I mean, I think in The Battle of Hermann, I think Kleist offers a slightly different perspective, which has got a far more direct propagandistic purpose. But in this text, yes, and I think it goes to the fact that there doesn't appear to be a genuine political justification for the collectivist ethics on the black side.
The collectivist ethics represented by Barbican is presented as very harsh and vengeful. I mean, she goes against her own daughter. She's only motivated by vengeance. There doesn't seem to be anything positive she's motivated by, nothing noble except vengeance. So Tony is the one who discovers individual ethics, and her discovery of individual ethics in the context in which she finds herself can't survive, but it's still presented, I think, as something noble, worthwhile, and, you know, it's sort of in this very fragile glimpse of their being united in death and the memory of her faithfulness. It's slender, much, much slenderer than in Weimar classicism. But still, I think, not a rejection of this individual ethics that Weimar classicism developed.
If we return to that remark by Tony, "I am a white girl," that remark has prompted some critics to see this story as inherently racist, because the individualistic concept of morality, this Kantian concept of morality, appears in the story to be aligned with the white cause. How far would you agree with that reading of the story? I'm sure you wouldn't.
Well, the frame of the story seems to suggest it, because it begins when the blacks were murdering the whites, and it ends with a mixed-race person saying, "I'm a white girl." But ultimately, I don't think the story is primarily about the black rebellion. It uses the black rebellion to think about the French Revolution, to think about revolutions in general, and what effect do they have on the individual and the moral choices? To what extent does society change because you abolish the ruling classes? I mean, the blacks murder all the whites and then themselves establish a murderous regime, just like in France, the guillotine killed a lot and, you know, was in itself as murderous as the regime it was trying to abolish. So that's the kind of thing that I think is the centre of the story. And to me, the black and white is very much the frame. It was very topical, and especially because it was this added frisson that the French Revolution was being turned against the French. You know, they themselves were now in the position of being the oppressors. And that kind of turnaround, of course, very much interested Kleist. So I think it's a story about general questions of power and morality rather than concretely race issues.
Steve? Yeah, I mean, just to follow on from that very quickly, I would say that also within the text itself, those characters who are guilty of thinking in what we would term as racial terms are Gustav and Barbican. And they're both essentially presented in a largely negative light. It's the way that they stick to those systems of thought that essentially prompts the tragic conclusion, in that it's Barbican's kind of rigid ethics that forces Tony to declare allegiance to the whites. But then it's Gustav's inability to look beyond his own kind of racial thinking that leads him to ultimately shoot Tony.
Well, given the extraordinary richness of Kleist's novella, it's probably hardly surprising that critics and readers have been so fascinated by it over the years. Thank you very much, Ricardo Schmidt and Stephen Howe.